This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. I'm Dean Beck and it's great to be with you today. Thank you so much for joining me. The French historian and philosopher Voltaire once said, "History consists of a series of accumulated imaginative inventions." But as an advocate of civil liberties and social reform, I think even he would be impressed by the work the Australian Gay and Lesbian Archives does to make sense of our rather underground queer past. A new book by the Archives, titled Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne, shines a light on our somewhat shady past. If nothing else, the book highlights the fact that lesbians and gays have been around in this city since pretty much day one. As Oscar Wilde said, any fool can make history, but it takes a genius to write about it. Please welcome the co-editor and one of the geniuses, behind the Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne, Daniel Marshall. Thanks for joining us, Word for Word.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. The book is the product of many hands. There are about a dozen writers who wrote pieces for the book, and there were two other editors for the book. And the book really came out of the history walks that the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives has been running since the 1980s.
So tell us about those.
So, like the way that the book is structured, the history walks really take people around different locations in the city, and over time they're focused on different parts of the city. So some points have been centred in the city. There was one that I did with Graham Willett around Melbourne University and Parkville. There've been the one that we did this year was in South Yarra and around that area. So they focus on particular parts of the city and they tell historical stories at particular locations.
Take us through one of those walks. Take us through the Parkville walk.
Well, I guess if we look at the book as an example, the book is structured around the map of the grid of the city, and it's designed so that readers can choose their own adventure, so to speak. So it's similar to books by Jeff and Jill Sparrow called Radical Melbourne. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those books, but they were similar in the sense that they had place-based anecdotes historically. And so with the Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne book, people could go around from location to location. So, for example, you could go to the old side of the Hotel Australia, which is now the Australia on Collins.
Ah, yes.
And that was where there was an infamous kiss-in after two gay men were charged for offensive behaviour by police. And so they can go to these places and they can, you know, reimagine history and reenact it if they like, and sort of choose history to become something that's exciting for them, you know, in a contemporary context.
What is the oldest, if you like, record of some sort of queer happening in Victoria?
Well, in Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne, some of the earliest chapters talk about the story of some female squatters who were companions, and they've left some documentary evidence about their companionship and a mourning brooch, which is housed in the State Library. The first chapter, I believe, in the book talks about bushrangers and some of the rumours that swirled around some of the bushrangers, but also some
It's a lonely life out there in the bush.
It is. That's right. And there were lots of men in Australia proportionally at that historical period in Australia, but also some of the stories about the affections of some of the police. And of course, because
Affections of some of the police.
Well, so in Graham's chapter, he talks about a police officer who was quite taken with some of his colleagues, apparently.
Right.
And of course, because the historical record relies heavily on legal accounts, court details, etc. A lot of the earliest kind of recordings that we have are of men who were getting in trouble for having sex, you know, in public places.
That bit's not changed.
Well, I guess it's a popular theme.
Well, let's explore some of those, if you like, rather interesting locales. Many of them have since been bulldozed, bricked up, absorbed, no longer exist. So to discover them, one would have to go through quite a lot of paperwork, I would have thought, unless how does it come to your attention?
Sure. So some of the places come to our attention through oral histories. The Archives has an oral history project. That's a very important part of remapping the history once things are lost. So in the book, we talk about, there's a chapter on a history of beats, and there's a discussion in that chapter about beats that men recall fondly, which...
And the first reference to this was in the 1800s.
Well, there is in the book, there's a discussion of a letter from a Mr. Cleal, I think, in 1901, who wrote a letter to the police commissioner, I believe, raising his concerns about unsavory activity that he saw going on at public toilets, and provided a list to the police of...
Somewhat detailed.
A very detailed list. And
both in its description of where, but also the happenings within.
Yes, it was quite a thorough account, as I understand it. And
one might suggest a little too thorough, but anyway.
And indeed the police officer who was dispatched to investigate these happenings did note that in his report.
Right.
That the complainant did possess quite a detailed knowledge of the occurrences. So people have been mapping these the queer traces through the city for a long time. Also, I guess we find accounts of queer happenings in historical locations, of course, through the popular press. And so another story is of people getting in trouble with the police for having sex in the Alexandra Gardens before it got tidied up with a lot of the foliage removed and bright lighting sort of put in the gardens. And so looking at the popular press, you get these accounts that are, you know, retrospectively are quite hilarious, where the police stumble upon a guy who's on his hands and knees and they say, well, what are you doing, you know, on your hands and knees, you know, in the dark, you know, in Alexandra Gardens. And he was saying that, well, you know, I'm looking for my pencil that I dropped. And no doubt the light... I mean, perhaps it was a euphemistic kind of expression.
Do you think?
But no doubt the improved lighting that happened after these concerns became publicly kind of aired would have aided him in sort of locating stationery.
And there's a lot to be thankful for with mowed lawns, surely. Daniel, the interesting thing I found in reading some of those extracts was the language that was used back then. It's, by our standards, perhaps a little flowery, but it's indicative of the time.
Can you give me an example?
I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah.
No, just the way it's worded, particularly the guy that was making the complaint to the police commissioner.
Yeah.
The way he worded things, I guess it was he wanted to be formal in his language. Mm-hmm. And it kind of is. But also was the commissioner's response.
Yes, I mean, I think that there's a very evocative language of moral decay and ruin, which I think might be what you're referring to.
Yes, indeed.
Which is very characteristic, I guess, of discussions of indecent, you know, sexual practices. The language of moral decay coding for, you know, illicit sex in terms of the way in which it was expressed in letters, you know, I think is quite a common kind of device.
There was an account of Mr. Morrison being whipped.
Ah, yes.
And it was reported in a newspaper. And the journalist wrote that if they were serious about making some sort of deterrent in regards to this morally corrupt behaviour, then perhaps the flagellator might want to be a little more energetic in future.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that we were pleased that we were able to do with the book was reproduce quite a lot of images, but also some archival...
Not enough images, by the way.
There's like 50 of them or something.
Oh, really?
Isn't it?
It's very heavy in the word, though.
Yeah, it is. It's a big book.
You've got to read it, ladies and gentlemen.
But the excerpt that you're referring to was actually an excerpt from a newspaper coverage of the whipping of this guy, and he was whipped by the cat of nine tails as well, mind you. And it was a routine flagellation that he was set to receive as part of his sentence.
Every fortnight or something stupid.
I can't exactly remember the period.
It was 25 every 2 weeks or something, I don't know.
But I think what is compelling about that passage is the way in which it works to try to inspire public lust for retribution, violence to be done against this man. And I guess, you know, we can sort of see that commentary in the papers working as a place where public opinion is actively being sought to be shaped in relation to the types of behaviour that should be meted out to people like that. And it's not only enough that he's imprisoned, that he's being whipped, but my goodness, you know, the guy's not really putting his back into it, you know.
Yes, so okay. Harder next time, thank you.
That's right. So, and of course, I mean...
It's interesting to draw those parallels to what's happening perhaps overseas. In other countries that aren't perhaps more as accepting as we are?
Well, I think, you know, it's there are so many differences across different locations. And just looking at the differences between the contemporary period in Melbourne and what happened then is a compelling kind of comparison. One of the things that we did in preparing the book for publication was go around to the sites that are marked on the map. And so I remember going to the... Old Melbourne Jail, which is where Morrison got flogged. And, of course, now it's, you know, it's...
RMIT.
Well, it's RMIT, but there's also, like, you know, a museum
thing
there. And in the square or the open area inside it, there are all of these people. They're just playing basketball or soccer or something. And, I mean, I think that's one of the things that I found compelling about working on this project is you sort of see these bizarre juxtapositions between this history, this really violent public history of...
On this very spot.
On this spot, which is now you have this very different kind of moment. And how do you reconcile those different historical points in time and how does that illuminate one and the other?
Next time you go for a wander through the streets of Melbourne, you just might not know what you're walking over the top of. Daniel, there was an interesting reference to a lesbian beat.
Sure. So there is some discussion from the 70s about the presence of a lesbian beat. There are different accounts as to where the lesbian beat occurred. And it's interesting to include that because I think people routinely think about beats as a gay male thing. And, you know, predominantly they are. And so it's interesting to kind of reflect on, you know, the archival fragments that we have, which tells us, you know, there were discussions around the idea of lesbian beats in the 70s that kind of, that people were talking about. And I think that it's just useful to kind of have those threads through the book because it tells us that sometimes things aren't as straightforward as we might imagine.
It's interesting that when heterosexual couples park alongside the beach to fornicate in their cars, etc., it's not considered a beat. but we even have a name for it in a gay lexicon.
Yes. I mean, and that was one of the interesting things about the Alexandra Gardens as well. You know, of course, heterosexual couples use the foliage and the darkness to have sex as well as gay couples. But it was gay men and sex workers and prostitutes who got a lot of the public kind of commentary through the press. You know, so I think that history is important to recount because it tells us the story about the way in which particular figures get wheeled out to wear society's condemnation in relation to issues around sex. Yeah.
Let's jump forward a little bit and explore that sort of mid-war period, if you like, that sort of from the 20s to the 40s. What was going on in Melbourne other than pretty much focused effort on battling wars?
Battling wars in between the war period, you mean?
Yeah, what was happening in Melbourne during that period, you know, 20s to 40s, before we kick into the 50s and 60s and the hedonistic times that are have laid ahead?
The archival record shows us that people found ways of meeting one another, but of course it wasn't in the public identifiable way that came into focus in the post-World War II period, when you see a lot more identifiable kind of circles of people. So,
but there were, I don't know, were they cafes or pubs or were that particular type of men tended to congregate?
So Wayne Murdoch, one of the editors of the book, has written a lot about this in the book. And so he talks about cafes and cafe culture in Melbourne, which was really important in the era of the 6 o'clock swill. And so that was the place where people would go and socialise. So cafes were a very important part of organising organising socially for bohemians, for camp men, for people who didn't fit into the you know, regular parts of society otherwise, because it was quite a conventional an acceptable place for people to go. Theatres. So there's a section around theatre land and around how theatres were a place where people could congregate and meet one another. Mm.
We're speaking with Daniel Marshall. He is one of the co-editors of The Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne, published by the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. Daniel, you're a bit young to be so interested in history, aren't you? Isn't that for old people?
No.
Okay. What got your interest in historical references? And I guess why is gay history a particular passion?
Okay, I suppose I became interested in volunteering at the archives during the period when I was writing my PhD, which was, I guess...
Now known as Dr. Daniel, right? Yes.
That's right. It's so glamorous doing a PhD. In my PhD, I was examining theories around queer history and around history and sexuality, and it was through that process that I became more interested in the work of the archives and in historical research in Australia per se. And so that's when I started volunteering at the archives and exploring my particular research interests through the holdings in the archives. And I think I'm also really drawn to the spirit of the archives, which it's a volunteer organisation. It's started in 1978. It locates itself in the community, and it's really there to work within the community and for the community, as opposed to perhaps some kind of institution that works outside of the community. And so, that was very attractive to me as something that I wanted to contribute to.
And on that basis, how are we doing as a community? Is the Gay and Lesbian Archive a complete or thorough reference like we would expect from a particular state library, for example?
Well, the The archives collects a broad range of material, not just lesbian and gay material, but trans, bi, queer, and other material that doesn't fit so neatly within those kind of identity categories. And of course, with any archive, you know, there are some areas where we need, you know, more to collect more material. Mm-hmm. Working on the book, one of the areas that I think that we need to collect more around is in relation to the Indigenous content in the collection. And so I think that's an area, you know, for growth. But as a community organisation, of course, our capacity to grow is linked to, you know, how many people are involved, and so it's really a project that is unfolding always, and so it's a work in progress, you know, 30 odd years on, yeah. But it's an amazing resource for anyone who hasn't checked it out, yeah.
I must come down because I have boxes full of magazines that I have kept from the mid-90s through to the early 2000s, and I don't know why I am still lugging them around from house to house, but I've always wondered whether it would be something that would interest the archives. How do we contribute? And do you often get, oh God, not that again, you know, walking through the door? Somebody thinks it might be of value to you and you've got 20 of them already?
Well, of course, there is a lot of duplication in what people collect. So we have a whole range of we list material so we know what we already hold, and you know, we have, for example, a listing of the periodicals. So when people come to us and say, "I've been collecting these magazines over this period of time, I've got this, this, and this," we can see if we've got gaps now in our collection. So
I might be able to help then.
Yeah, that would be terrific. We have that information on our website, which people can get to by Googling our name. So that would be, you know, a first point of call, I guess. And we're always, you know, happy to have conversations with people about ways of organising material that they might want to bring in, because there are ways that people can do that. That would be really helpful for us.
Is there a goal to create some sort of museum, or is how is this stuff stored? Because I would imagine to us as a community, it's very valuable.
Yeah. So the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives is currently housed in the VAC building in South Yarra, and we're very grateful for their generosity in housing us there. During our 30th anniversary year, we had a large fundraising drive, which has enabled us to fit out some of the space that we have at the VAC. So we now have a brand new Compactus, for those of you out there who get really excited about
Many do.
It's glistening grey. new shelving as well. So we now have a space where volunteers can have access to natural light and running water, which is very attractive for people.
Bloody luxury!
Of course, you know, recently Vic Bears just raised $10,000 for the archives, which is an amazing achievement as well. So it's with support like that, you know, which is really encouraging, you know, in terms of facing, you know, the issues that the archives will face in the future in terms of preserving and making this material accessible.
Mm. Well, there's a lot of politics in the gay and lesbian community, but I would imagine one thing we could be universally thankful for is the fact that there are people like yourself maintaining, caring for, and reporting on our history. So I think I thank you for that, and I think it's pretty important that we continue to contribute to it.
Well, it's a large group effort. You know, there's a committee, there's volunteers who've been doing this work for a long time. So,
what do you get out of it?
The archives has been running since 1978. You know, obviously I've been involved for a shorter period of time. I guess you know, since about perhaps maybe 2004 or so. And I think walking into the collection, you just see how remarkable it is. And so I guess, maintaining it and helping it to grow, facilitating people's access to it, keeping it going. I think that's, you know, an enriching thing to do. Yeah.
Good stuff. Daniel Marshall is the co-editor of The Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne. Now, Daniel, we were talking earlier about the sort of war period. Let's look at what's happened after the war and explore a name that will be synonymous to many listeners in the gay and lesbian community, Freddie Asmussen. Now, he was the head of the display department at my city store here in Melbourne. Let's talk about Freddie and his boys.
Graham Willett wrote a chapter on Freddie Asmussen in the book, and in that chapter he talks about the way in which Freddie created a space at
very accepting space,
a very accepting space by those accounts where young fae men could get employment.
And people of a creative persuasion, yes, yes.
Apparently it was quite hotly sought after, this vocational position, because it attributed you with a particular kind of status within certain circles, and there was a lot of competition.
And protection.
And protection, I guess. And they could link into networks of other camp people as well.
And it was very welcoming of people who were transgender or gender questioning or flamboyant, as long as you were good creatively, I imagine.
Well, in the chapter,
I'm hoping that's all it was.
Graham recounts stories of the floats that that Freddie, yes, and Freddie's boys would put together.
And it was under his reign, was it not, that the windows, Christmas windows, became?
That's right. So the Christmas windows are what's left of a broader
tradition
of, yeah, decorating windows, and by all accounts, the decoration was very over the top, and Graham talks about there being this hidden floor almost in Myers where Freddie would store all of this
the props
in this gilt and these, you know, fancy furniture that he would wheel out for particular kinds of events. So it does create quite a surreal kind of retrospective image.
As an old display queen myself, it saddens me to see today that the only effort that shops go to is a couple of decals and some mannequins at best. That whole idea of creating a story and telling or transforming the fashion into a story has gone. And Freddie was to be commended. But there was a lot of competition associated with being one of Freddie's boys. The Georges, David Jones, and Maya were in hot competition.
Yes, yes.
Now let's move along to the story of the ASIO involvement with the gay history of Melbourne.
Oh, so
the Secret Service.
So similar, I guess, to the excerpt in relation to the flogging of Morrison, the book features some other excerpts from some ASIO documents around male homosexuals, because of course in the Cold War period, the post World War II period, there was a lot of anxiety around communism, and
so we're talking around the 50s, 60s, yeah. Yep.
And there was a connection. People made a connection between communism and homosexuality, and part of the way in which the argument
clearly right, bloody pinko comic bastards.
Part of the arguments that were made were that homosexuals, security agencies were concerned by this kind of mystical connection that homosexuals seem to have one with another, a kind of an identification or an allegiance which would supplant or exceed the bonds of nationalism. So,
if nothing else, we were good at manifesting and maintaining an underground presence, I guess. maybe that's drawing a long bow, but we had to fly under the radar for so long.
I think that the anxieties around homosexuality that were expressed as part of the anti-communist paranoia picked up on those broader kind of concerns about, you know, male about homosexuality as being something that is subterranean and something that's you can't quite identify but need to worry about.
Now, there's a chapter titled A Melbourne Homosexual.
Yes.
With regards to the former site of the ASIO headquarters.
Yes, yeah, so that refers to a document in which a Melbourne homosexual is interviewed and provides information to security personnel about how to identify homosexuals and about...
how to spot them.
And about... homosexual practices. And this is interesting because it gives us an insight into the way in which security personnel were thinking about homosexuals not that long ago, really, and this kind of bizarre sort of anthropological kind of...
Profiling.
Yeah.
Any evidence to suggest that some of these ASIO heads or officers were in fact themselves homosexual?
Oh, I couldn't comment on
that. Oh, it's classified. Oh, dear.
Not my field.
The emergence of the Seahorse Club, which has been around for years,
yes,
and remains to this day.
Yeah,
the Seahorse Club are a particular organisation that are there to embrace and welcome transsexuals.
Yes, so there's a great chapter in the book that details the history of the club.
Many of which are not gay.
It's a club for trans people.
Yeah.
And they talk in the chapter. There's a great discussion about moving venues for the club, and moving out of a person's apartment to moving into a bridal suite of a hotel, and talking about the nerve-wracking experience of going and collecting the keys from reception when people are rocking up for their meeting at the bridal suite. So it's one of the things which was pleasurable about working on the book is that you get these evocative kind of images of moments in time historically about how these groups came into being.
I remember working behind the bar at Three Faces in its early days, and the Seahorse Club would arrive very early, shortly after the doors opened, but on a night which was generally quieter. They would all drink orange juice. None of them drank alcohol. And they were there just to socialise amongst themselves in a safe space. And, it was... And by the time that the general club crowd was coming in, they would slowly disappear.
Yes.
It's an interesting organisation.
Yes.
But an important one.
Absolutely.
Now, I guess the gay revolution really kicked in from the early 70s, and Melbourne's inner north became really a hub for the emergence of, I guess, the gay scene as we start to begin to know it as today.
Sure. I think that the rise of gay liberation and gay and lesbian activist politics, lesbian feminist politics, as we can identify them now, really was accelerated in the 70s by the material support that was provided through the Australian Union of Students, through clubs that were set up, you know, at Melbourne University especially. And so... Some of those reasons account for why there was a lot of activity, you know, in the north. And it really was a vibrant period. And, of course, we have a lot of material on that because that's when the period when we start to see the emergence of or the really acceleration of gay and lesbian print media, magazines, periodicals. And the archives has, you know, the most comprehensive collection of LGBTIQ periodicals, Australian periodicals anywhere. And, you know, we have this rich kind of account of that period from those periodicals that started during that time. So it certainly was a really active kind of period.
The Dover Hotel, which is on the corner of Lygon and Victoria Streets in Carlton, was sort of the emergence of that new scene. And then the gay rights movement kicked in, and there was a particular picnic that really kicked things off, I believe. There's a number of picnics, really, wasn't there? Various organisations have emerged from those gatherings.
Yes, yeah. So there's a story in the book about a gay lib picnic and some of the games that happened there and some nice pictures too.
Let's talk about the taking of action on D-Day at the Floral Clock on St Kilda Road.
Yeah.
Because that was somewhat disturbing to many.
Sure. I mean, so that is a chapter that talks about ACT UP's response to a lack of government support in relation to funding for HIV medication.
And they basically destroyed the Floral Clock.
They basically destroyed the Floral Clock, but it was it's a great chapter because it kind of provides this an activist's diary of the series of things that happened, which involved the Floral Clock, as well as issuing a press release, and it was quite controversial because it was shocking to many people in Melbourne because many people value the Floral Clock. But as I think one of the slogans that they used for that during that protest was that, well, the Floral Clock will grow back.
Right.
Whereas people who were relying on HIV medication that they weren't able to access, we're not facing the same kind of situation.
I remember that particular event, but I can't remember whether I was in Melbourne or still in my hometown of Bendigo, but I do remember that event, and I remember it really upsetting me that type of action was taken, that there must or there could have been a better way. But I guess looking at it now, one wonders whether it took such extreme defiance to actually make a difference.
Mm. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the book is that you can, even though it's not written, it's not a comprehensive narrative history of LGBTIQ Melbourne. It's a series of snapshots, really, organised by place. But what you can see by putting those different place-based stories one against another is this different approach to politics and these different ways of thinking about and doing politics. And I think that that's a really rich kind of reflection to have because of the contemporary debates around, politics and sexuality.
There's two chapters on the MCG.
Mm. Graham wrote some chapters on the MCG. One of them is focusing on fans and how fan culture
sports crowds,
football fans, provided a space for some camp and gay and lesbian people, trans people to develop social networks, and we're very involved.
There's the Collingwood Pink Cheer Squad thing.
He talks about and then another kind of talks about some of the popular kind of commentary around homosexuality in football in the 90s, later than that, with the press around Shane Crawford and that type of stuff.
It's an extraordinary phenomenon that here in a hyper-masculine environment, one can understand the attraction for gay men to view such a spectacle. Yet if, it's supposed to be the ultimate battle, etc. And the crowds are generally quite homophobic, one would presume, and yet in the middle of it all, there's this bunch of poofs and dykes going off equally.
Mm. Mm.
And they're there every time.
Yes, yeah. The comment is made in the chapter that people's animosity towards people who backed a different club exceeded any kind of homophobia. So it's kind of like a solidarity,
a solidarity. That bit's not changed.
Quite a Melbourne story. Mm.
And something that certainly remains very much in my mind is the Tasty Raid at Flinders Lane. Now, that venue had quite a bit of a queer, gay history much prior to Tasty.
Yeah, one of the themes that comes up through the book again is the significant role that police have played in the, you know, the histories that we're recounting. And one of the so in Tasty, of course, it details the police raid and how traumatic that was. But it kind of recalls earlier stories about police strategies. And I'm thinking now of the Police Go Gay chapter from the 70s, when police were arresting men at the Black Rock Beach beat after they had practiced that particular walk that they saw homosexual men do, and would then dispatch the attractive officers in plain clothes to the beat, you know, mimicking that particular walk. And lo and behold, they successfully managed to have a large number of arrests, which kind of resulted in campaigning against that. So I think that it is interesting to kind of reflect on the significant role that policing has played in relation to histories of homosexuality in Melbourne.
And it also gives us a point of reference to which we can acknowledge how far we have come, and in some instances what we have learnt, in others what we haven't. And the secret history of gay Melbourne is an extraordinary documentary of how we as a community have managed to battle on through. And for many, it's a battle that continues.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that the political terrain for the battles that we negotiate in relation to sexual and gender difference is always evolving. So hopefully this book provides a useful kind of a useful and engaging kind of resource for people who are wanting to explore
those politics. As a co-editor, you have drawn from various essays and other books to put this together. It's come together very, very well. Are you pleased with the result?
It's been a long process, and it's pleasing to be able to provide a platform for these stories. I guess our hope at the archives is that people take it up and make of it something that's useful for them. So, and the response so far has been really positive, so we're really happy about that.
And I imagine it would be an essential reference in libraries around Australia.
Well, it's because its focus is Melbourne-based, I guess people who are in Melbourne and, you know, are going to have more of a kind of interest in it, but...
Daniel, I'm trying to get the librarians in our other states listening to pick it up.
Well...
Work with me here.
Yeah, I'm not very good at flogging it off.
You're an historian. That's fine. That's fine. Dr. Daniel Marshall is the co-editor of The Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne. He has joined us from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. You can find out so much more and more about the book too at alga.org.au. Daniel Marshall, thank you so much for joining us Word for Word.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about the book and to promote it and to get the word out about the archives as well.
It's our absolute pleasure. You've been with Dean Beck today on Word for Word. Thank you so much for joining us. You will find a podcast and a transcript of this interview available for download from Joy's website, joy.org.au. And if you would like to correspond with the show, simply email wordforword@joy.org.au. I'm Dean Beck. Till next time, you take care and bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
podcast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.